Happy to be here. And I'll be talking about this heterotic axion model. We call it warp heterotic axion. This is a work in progress that I'm doing with my student, Rhiannon. And a postdoc, Hassan Firoz Shahi. So my interest in the subject, actually it's a question of cosmology, but I'm more interested in string theory. And the reason why I got interested in the subject was because it gave rise to a new way of constructing manifolds which are not scalar. So I was more interested along that direction. It turned out when I told this thing to Hassan, he said, actually, we can use this manifold to solve this axion problem. So first, let me tell you what is an axion problem, and then I'll tell you how to solve it. And I'll also tell you how to construct new manifolds which are not scalar. So as you know, from the very beginning of QCD, there was this issue that in the QCD Lagrangian, you can add the following term. This perfectly allowed term in the QCD Lagrangian, but it's a CP violating term. And since, so this can alternatively be written as theta FOHF in four dimension. And since FOHF is an integer, theta can be made to be an angular parameter. Now, since this is a completely allowable term in QCD Lagrangian, so the question was why theta cannot take any value between 0 and 2 pi. What was the reason for theta not taking any value between 0 and 2 pi? Experimentally, it was found that theta, the value of theta has to be very, very small. It's order 10 to the power of minus 6. So the question was, which we call the strong CP problem, is that why the value of theta is so small instead of taking value from 0 to 2 pi. Now, as you know, as you also know very well, the solution was proposed by Pecci and Quinn, and they said that actually, if there exists a dynamical field called the axion, which we'll call as A, then there can be a axion coupling in the theory, which is A, F, wedge, F. And this axion has a property that A plus a constant is also a symmetry of the theory. And you can choose the constant in such a way that you can absorb such theta parameter in your theory. So the Pecci and Quinn idea was that you can actually have an axion, a scalar field in your theory with this property. A scalar field having this property means that it's always interacting in terms of derivatives. A scalar field with this property can eat up this axion and solve this problem. So this was the proposed solution for the strong CP problem. Now, as you can easily see, such kind of thing can naturally appear in string theory because axion in string theory is very natural. One of the simplest way axion can appear in string theory is from the antisymmetric tensor field. Called the B mu nu. If this antisymmetric tensor field has legs along the space-time direction, then this term, the action for this term is H wedge star of H. And if you dualize this H, then you know that star of H is D of some scalar in four dimensions. So this Lagrangian will become dA wedge star dA. And this will be our axion in our theory. So string theory has a very simple way of allowing axion, which are nothing but the anti-symmetric Nebu-Schwartz field. And the action for this anti-symmetric Nebu-Schwartz field is given by that quantity. So, yes.
There is also an axion in the D-Lachman multiplet, right?
Axion?
In the D-Lachman multiplet, in the supermultiplet.
That's right. In that 2B theory, there is also an axion dilaton. I'll be talking about mostly of the heterotic theory, where the heterotic theory, the axion actually is indeed component. But now, so if it occurs very naturally, then we should be able to see some cosmological consequences. And it was known that the axion decay constant, we'll define a little bit later, the axion decay constant, which we'll call F of A, is a cosmological window. And it says that axion decay constant has to be greater than 10 to the power of 9 GeV, but less than 10 to the power of 12 GeV. So this is an observation over here. So you might be wondering what happened if the axion decay constant is less than 10 to the power of 9. It turns out that if the axion decay constant is less than 10 to the power of 9, then the axion will interact very strongly. And if it interacts very strongly, then there is a problem over here. Similarly, if the axion decay constant is much greater than 10 to the power of 12, then the axion will interact very weakly. And if it interacts very weakly, then there are lots of axionic dark matter, which is again problem with the cosmological observation. And therefore, you see that, for example, if the axion decay constant is less than 10 to the power of 9, then the red giant will cool very fast, because it will cool by giving rise to axion, which is again contrary to what you observe. So the axion decay constant has to lie between this one. So if we have a string model which says that the axion decay constant lies between this, then we should be OK, at least from string theory. Yeah.
What
is the bound?
On solar axion production, is that in the lower bound there? Or?
Solar axion production should be in the lower bound. So I didn't know much about these things, so I went to some conference and I heard all this talk, and then we realized that maybe it is possible to resolve some of these issues. But before I go into this, I should point out that there is an actual tension in string theory between the axion decay constant and the string result. And this was pointed out by Peter Schwarzschild and Witten. That the axion decay constant naturally is greater than 10 to the power of 12. GeV in natural string theory compactification. So let's see where does the problem comes, and then we'll try to see whether we can resolve this issue and try to construct a model where the axion decay constant is under reasonable control within this window. So what happens is that in string theory, as I pointed out, that it's very natural to construct such an interaction in string theory, especially in heterotic theory. And if you know, in a heterotic theory, heterotic theory has the following multiplet. It has a metric, it has an antisymmetric tensor, and a dilaton, that's all. But you know that this kind of multiplet creates anomalies in the theory, and therefore you need to add a vector bundle in this theory. And the vector bundle is a non-abelian vector bundle, and this quantity A is the non-abelianness, and it says that the vector bundle has to be either SO32 on E8 cross E8. With this choice of multiplet, the theory is completely anomaly free. Now, such a multiplet actually can give rise to the following Lagrangian. So let me write down the Lagrangian in Einstein frame. So this is the metric. This is the dilaton interaction. Then there is a NSNS interaction. And then so this is the kind of interaction we see in the heterotic theory. And this trace is in the adjoint representation of F. And by definition, F square, by definition, is F wedge star of F, or F mu nu. And this is in the adjoint representation, so big trace in the adjoint representation. Similarly, H square, by definition, is H wedge star of H. And you can contract the property. So this is the generic action for a heterotic theory. And now, as you could see, there is a there is an interaction of the form trace of F square. So we have to see whether we can actually have an axionic-like interaction. And you may also know very well that D of H is not equal to 0, but rather it's equal to trace R wedge R minus trace F wedge R. This is in the fundamental representation of the holonomy group, and traces is in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. This is a factor of 1 by 30, which by which you can actually map from one representation to another. So with this Lagrangian, actually, one can see the following interesting thing. Let's look at the first term. The first term is of the form to solve this, to study this issue of axion, we have to also specify the background. So let's first specify the background. We'll take the following background, for example. The metric of my background will look like so this is my space-time. So 10-dimensional is divided into two parts. One is the 6 and other is 10. Now GMN is the metric of anything. It could be a Calabi-Yau, or it could be a non-Killer manifold. And HW is the warp factor, okay? Now GMN, I wrote it, you can write it in terms of eta MN also, eta mu nu also. Eta mu nu is the flat metric. So this is my choice of the metric I'll take. So I'm taking a heterotic theory on this kind of metric, and I'll assume that there is a background H and S and S field. Okay, now you can easily see that if you plug this in over here, this quantity will become D4X. Let's write it as G mu nu for simplicity. Let's write it as G bar mu nu, G bar R bar so this is the 6-dimensional internal space. Where kappa square is by definition and this is the string mass. This is my unit. Kappa square is the Newton constant associated with the string length alpha prime and associated with the string mass in the following way. So this is the decomposition in this space. So G bar is my space-time metric, G6 is my internal space, and you see that this 10-dimensional action decomposes into something 4-dimensional times some quantity over here. Okay? And we can call 1 by 2 kappa square D6y root G6 as M Planck square.
Thank you.
There is no, it's an Einstein frame, so in this case there is no dilaton hanging here. As you could see that I have put everything in Einstein frame, so there is no e to the power of minus pi. Instead, e to the power of pi has gone here, and it should go over here also.
To clarify, so in the string frame, there would be a G-string square sitting in the definition of kappa square, is that right?
In the string frame, yes. So, in Einstein frame, this is how, and I'm taking Einstein frame because this is the frame at which you can do all the measurement. So, you see, this is how I could write the four-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action, and therefore the four-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action is just mp square. Square root of d4x So this is how I write this one, and now let's look at the other term, which is the other relevant term in this case, and this term is basically the axionic term, which is this term. So in 10 dimension, this term will look like 1 by 2 kappa square d10x e to the power of minus pi h wedge star of h. And if I assume that all the legs of the H field is in my spacetime, in the four-dimensional spacetime, then this interaction will simply become 1 by 2 kappa square d4x h wedge star of h. And then multiplied by integral d6y multiplied by something d6y square root of g to the power d6 e to the power of minus pi h w. Okay? So this is my internal space. You see how the dilaton has entered here, because I'll assume that the dilaton is function of the internal coordinate. And the warp factor, which is a function of the internal space, has gone here. And this is my kinetic term. So I have decomposed the 10-dimensional the Nebu-Schwartz term into a 4-dimensional and a 6-dimensional term. Similarly, the Einstein-Hilbert term is divided into a 4-dimensional and a 6-dimensional term. It's a very straightforward thing. And now we could define a quantity called beta, for example. I can define a quantity called beta, and beta is defined in the following way. I can define a quantity beta, and you'll see the usefulness of this quantity. This quantity beta can be used to write this term in the following way. So this is the Einstein-Hilbert term, S1. And S2 could be written as beta M Planck square, square root of d4x h with So you see, I have decomposed the 10-dimensional term into two terms. One is the Einstein-Hilbert term in 4-dimension and the axionic term in 4-dimension. One comes with M Planck square, other comes with beta times M Planck square, and beta is this definition. Beta is nothing but divide this divided by that.
Axion with this definition, is it 2 pi?
2 pi, yes. Okay, so with this definition, now we are all set to actually go ahead and see the exact axionic coupling in the hadronic theory. I'm repeating everything from Schwarzschild and Witten paper, so this is nothing too profound. It's already been there in the literature. And Witten and Schwarzschild has written this very nicely and clearly. Some of the notation I'm using in a different way than that's given in their paper, but it's more or less the repetition of what's been done there. Now you see the following interesting thing, that the heterotic coupling is given by beta, not the HNSNS coupling is given by beta M Planck square d4x h wedge star of h. However, you also know that d of h is not closed, but is given by trace r wedge r minus trace f wedge. I can incorporate such an interaction in my Lagrangian by a Lagrange multiplier. And I can rewrite this action S2 in the following way. I introduce a Lagrange multiplier here. And then I write it as dH minus trace r wedge r minus trace f wedge r. You see that it contains all information correctly because this is the kinetic term of the NSNS, and I've used the Lagrange multiplier and added this term. It's easy to see that using this Lagrange multiplier, if you integrate this out, this quantity will become 1 by beta M Planck square dA wedge star dA plus A trace F wedge F minus trace R wedge R. You see, this is precisely the kinetic term for an axion, and this is exactly the QCD coupling, which is no surprise. String theory is the theory of everything should involve everything. So hence, it does involve the QCD stuff. But problem comes when you actually calculate the decay constant. So I have to first define to you what is the decay constant. But now you see there is a weird coefficient in front of it. This some factor of minus half and all, I'm ignoring this factor. But you can redefine. You can redefine A tilde in the following way. You can say that A tilde is defined as 1 by square root of beta M Planck square A. With this definition, the action for the string theory becomes, action from the string theory becomes the natural action for the axionic theory. And the natural action is in terms of A tilde, and the action becomes d A tilde wedge star d A tilde. Okay, I think I used the wrong, so this is the inverse. No, I think this is fine. No, this is all fine.
I think you always assume that the Dilaton only depends on the internal coordinates. But yes. You really have to make that assumption. You could just as well include the beta in the integrals and still do the same field definition. And
right. So if I assume that the Dilaton has some dependence on the space-time direction, that's one of the issue. That would mean that there is a non-trivial coupling constant in four dimensions. I'm trying to avoid that issue. That leads to more complicated scenario. So if I avoid that issue, if I assume that dilaton only depends upon the internal coordinate, then at least four dimensions, we know that dilaton has no dependence. So it will not lead to any complications here. But you see, this Lagrangian is very simple. But all we have to do is to reinterpret things. And if I write it in terms of A tilde, then this quantity will become root beta M Planck A tilde trace F wedge F minus trace R wedge R. Okay? So this is how it's been written over here. And axionic decay constant is exactly the inverse of this. So if you actually look, open up the QCD action, you find that the action for a QCD is given by is how the QCD action is written, and therefore the axionic decay constant, you can read it up from string theory, and the axionic decay constant is of the form 1 by square root of beta M prime. It turns out that I have missed some factor of kappa square. If you put it correctly, I think it is a factor of M string square. But this is what the result which comes from string theory. Now you see that this is where the result, now all you have to do is to figure out this value from string theory. If it lies in our window, lies in this window, that f of a is less than 10 to the power of 12 GeV, greater than 10 to the power of 9 GeV, we are all set. If it is not, then there is a tension. What Swetchek and Witten have shown, that there is indeed a tension, and where is the tension coming from, that we'll see now. So let's take a typical example of in string theory where a result could, such thing could be calculated. So one of the simplest case would be to actually take a string compactification, and we know one string compactification that we know very well is a Calabi-Yau compactification. So heterotic theory Calabi-Yau threefold. Now it's very simple to see that Calabi-Yau threefold, the metric for a Calabi-Yau threefold is nothing but eta mu nu dx mu dx nu plus Calabi-Yau metric. You really don't have to know the Calabi-Yau metric to do this, but you see that the Wolf factor is actually 1 over here. If you plug in the value of Wolf factor 1, beta will turn out to be exactly 1. And therefore, axionic decay constant from this calculation will be ms square by mp, which to our order is just ms. And ms is way above 10 to the power of 12 GeV. So a natural Calabi-Yau compactification leads the following simple tension between the result from string theory, that it leads to an axionic decay constant way above what you expect. Now you might think that, okay, that's not good. Calabi-Yaus are not very good because we have made more progress. And the progress we have made is on using warped compactification. Maybe warped compactification in heterotic theory should save our life. So we try the warped compactification. So let's try an example two. But we know that there is some subtlety between a warped compactification and the heterotic theory. In a heterotic theory, we know that if you switch.
Large,
would
you make it smaller?
Kolmogorov has played around with these kind of results. All of these results look a little unnatural, because you have to take large internal volume and all, so there is a, so you have to say that M string is very, very small compared to M prime. Now that becomes a little unnatural. But Kolon has written a paper saying that's such a way to save it, but there is a more natural way to save it. We don't have to go to extreme end, but at least with this Calabi-Yau thing,
it's unnatural in what sense? Because the compactification manifold is weird, or
Compactification manifold is not such weird. But the thing is that it's difficult to argue why MS and M Planck are not of same value.
Why do you expect this?
I'll talk about this when we take the volume of that space into account, whether it saves us or not. But in this case, it will turn out that this result is exactly equal to M string. There is no M prime dependence, so the M prime dependence cancels out completely. This is equal to M string. But you may think that maybe the volume, if you adjust the volume of the internal space or something like that, you should be able to save this one. Okay? So we'll try to see whether we can take a warped compactification, take large volume and all, whether we can save this or not. But
horrible plans, you mean, right? I mean, if you drop M string compared to M Planck like three orders of magnitude, wouldn't that put you in that range?
Okay, so in general, the M string is greater than 10 to the power of 16. Okay, so you have to bring it down to this order, 10 to the power of 12.
So
No, 10 to 15, 10 to 15.
No, no, because you canceled, you said that, when you did that, you said the M string and M flank are roughly the same.
Actually, here I said that, but if you plug this in over here, you'll find that square root of beta actually cancels this M flank. It's not 1, so it's 1. It cancels the M flank, so the result is only M string, only MS, not the M flank part cancels out, okay, if you plug in the value of beta. Because you see what is beta over here. Beta is nothing but this thing divided by that, and this quantity by definition is M Planck square. So beta involves the square root of M Planck, and that square root of M Planck square it cancels out.
So you're saying that beta is only
MS.
1 if M Planck and M string are the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now let's take another example, which is a warp compactification, and this might be able to save us. So the warp compactification that we'll take is a heterotic string. With an NSNS field. If you take a heterotic thing, a string with each NSNS field, you know that the background cannot remain a Calabi-Yau manifold. So if I switch on a, if I take our six-dimensional manifold like that, and I switch on an HNSNS field, the background fails to remain a Calabi-Yau, and in fact, it becomes a manifold which is not scalar. So you have to take such an example. That one known example in this, this is rather difficult because we actually don't know of any example of this except one example, and one example that we know is of the form a non-trivial torus vibration over a K3 manifold. So I have a six-dimensional manifold, which base is a K3, and the torus is non-trivially fibered, so it's not a product. And the manifold is non-trivially fibered like that, and the metric for this space, for the internal six-dimensional space, looks the following, that it has a non-trivial, let's call the coordinate of the torus as x and y, then it's dx plus alpha squared, dy plus beta squared, plus up to some possible warp factor. So the warp factor is e to the power of p pi by 2, pi is the dilaton, e to the power of minus pi by 2. Where alpha and beta are exactly one forms, not globally defined, but they are one forms on K3. These one forms are not globally defined, but the field strength of these one forms are globally defined on K3. So you see that dx plus alpha squared, so alpha has one leg on the K3, beta has one leg on the K3, and therefore this vibration is non-trivial. And then there is a K3 manifold. So there is a K3 with a torus vibration. This is known. This is an exact solution in string theory. And therefore, the complete 10-dimensional metric for this case can be written in the following way. So the complete 10-dimensional metric for this heterotic compactification can be written as e to the power of minus pi by 2 eta mu nu. And this is ds square 6 is like that. So this is all fine, except if you carefully compare this with this, you can show that e to the power of minus pi is hw to the power of 4. Just comparing this and that. If you plug this in there, and you'll find that beta is again equal to 1. So if you take a warp compactification in heterotic theory, you also have this exactly the same problem with unwarped case. Because you see the dilaton depends upon the warp factor, and there is no known solution in heterotic theory in which the dilaton is not proportional to the warp factor. All solution in heterotic compactification with fluxes shows that the dilaton has to be proportional to the warp factor. this is by solving the equation of motion. And therefore, all the known background in heterotic theory creates the tension between the result of cosmological bound and the string theory result. This was the main conclusion of the paper by Swercheck and Witten. But they do find example in which actually it can be brought by just tuning things. You can bring it somehow down to this value, 10 to the power of 12. But those are very unnatural, as they themselves claim. So we started to think about this problem, and we found that the problem lies over here. If we can make a dilaton independent of the internal volume or independent of the warp factor, then we might be able to save this. So since no examples were known, we wanted to construct new example. So we wanted a new example in which the manifold is non-killer. Yet the dilaton is independent of warp factor, or at least some part of it is independent of warp factor. What we could construct, we can construct two examples in which, one example in which the dilaton is independent of the radial coordinate, other example, dilaton is completely independent of the, it's just a constant, yet the manifold has following warping. So these examples are not known, so we started to construct these example. And first, let me give you an answer, and then I'll tell you how we constructed these manifolds.
On this constant, I thought these manifolds have a name or something.
A half-life.
Okay.
But I'll give you an example in which dilaton is independent of the radial coordinate. The simplest example I'll give you. And this we constructed using the equivalence between 2,2 sigma model. To 0,2 heterotic sigma model. You can use this equivalence to construct such such case. So the example that we constructed, the metric has the following form. So it looks like the following simple case. As simple as that. And the dilaton is a function of these internal coordinate, but it's independent of the radial coordinate. So the metric that we were able to construct was a warped ADS, but it's not X5. It's something we don't know what it is. We know what it is, but I don't know whether such manifold has been studied before. It's not an S5, but a rather complicated manifold. And it actually comes from the original ADS5 cross S5 by some duality transformation. And if I call the coordinate of S5 as gamma, phi1, phi2, psi, phi3, then the metric of this space can be written in the following way. So metric of this space has the following form. this is this form, and you can see that this part would have combined to give you an ADS 5, but has an overall strange warp factor. So this is my space-time, and this is the rest of the space. And the dilaton, in this case, is actually independent of the radial coordinate. And then there is a non-trivial torsion, non-trivial H and S and S, which we call the torsion. This quantity R is the scale of ADS, and it's given by 4 pi G string N square root. So the dilaton is independent. The metric has almost a form of a warped ADS times some X5 space. But this space is actually non-compact. The rest of the space is non-compact. So we have a metric which looks like that, but this quantity is actually, this quantity combined with the radial direction, there is a non-compact radial direction. So what we do is that we cut off that non-compact radial direction and put a finite cap. So I know the local geometry, but I don't know the full global geometry of this thing. But you'll find that the detail about the global geometry is irrelevant if we can specify the warp factor like that. So the manifold will look like an X5 over here times a radial direction, which is non-compact. So there is a overall radial direction, for example, a radial direction like that, which is non-compact. So what I do is that I cut off the radial direction and put some finite cap over here. And to avoid the singularity at R equal to 0, we cut it off at the infrared as well as at ultraviolet. At the infrared, we cut off at R equal to R0. And at the ultraviolet, we connect it to some finite space. At the infrared, the warp factor you see will be proportional to near the infrared of the geometry. The warp factor is given by H0, and it's proportional to so N is defined from type 2B, where it's related to the five form flux. And here, in this case, is related to the amount of torsion.
So you're integrating the torsion over some 3-cycle or something?
Yeah.
What is that 3-cycle?
So you have to find 3-cycle inside that space, inside this X5. And on that 3-cycles, you have to find the torsion. And exactly the 3-cycle is along that direction. D gamma wedge D phi 1 wedge D phi 3 wedge D psi. So this is the 3-cycle from which you can add the torsion.
Does that three-factor, it looks like it would vanish if you took the usual periods for the angles at various points. Do you just
cut?
So your p-factor, your sine, psi, cosine, sine gamma thing.
Yeah, for certain value it will vanish. So in the type 2B picture, what we did is that there are points at which actually this manifold may become singular.
That was second point.
Right. So what we did is that those points, we actually eliminate those points and put some finite, for example, I'll tell you how we got it. We got it by some sigma model identification. The point at which actually this manifold becomes infinite is the point at which the cycle shrinks to zero size here. Okay? You can show that there are cycles which are shrinking to zero size on S5. And these are exactly the point where it actually becomes infinite. So what we did is that since we mapped this model by certain something we call a U-duality, which is T-duality and S-duality, the point at which the cycle shrinks to zero size, the T-dualities are not well-defined picture. So what we did is that we removed those points completely from the original picture, and then we found a result which looks like that. And interestingly, if we actually calculate the value of beta or whatever in this kind of manifold, you'll find that the dependence on the cutoff is logarithmic, only logarithmic, which actually does not. As long as we put some cutoff over here at the point at which the cycle shrinks to zero size, Then here, it's all the singularities are under control. So this is the manifold we constructed, and you can show that this manifold, the torsion is actually not closed. You can have a setup in which the torsion is actually not closed. And finally, using this analysis, we find that f of a if we carry on this calculation, f of a turns out to be again proportional to ms, but it also depends upon this quantity. It's the only change which happens. All this calculation, you'll find that all the rest of the stuff, there are lots of other constants, but these constants are quite insensitive to cutoff very good, insensitive to all the possible cutoff. In fact, depends only logarithmically on the cutoff. But the crucial point is here. The axiomatic decay constant is proportional to M string, but has a warp factor over here. And therefore, if you can control the warp factor, we should be able to bring H naught is the warp factor right at the infrared of our geometry.
How is it defined intrinsically?
Okay, this is
So are you assuming that such a manifold globally exists, or you have arguments that it has to exist?
We have argument that it has to exist. We have the local description of the geometry away from the singular point. We have a local description of the geometry away from the singular point, and we control the singularities over here, so that we have a controlled description over here. But we don't have the global picture. How does the manifold looks like locally?
So then what is R0?
Okay. R0 is the value of the radial coordinate where we cut off the geometry at the near R equal to 0. Near R equal to 0, you see that the geometry has a singularity here.
Does it have an intrinsic meaning in terms of the manifold? Or it's unclear?
It's not clear at this stage what is the intrinsic meaning of that. All we did is that we cut off the geometry at the infrared. And this has been done many times in the literature. It's, they always have this area space, always has that problem that R equal to 0, you have this kind of behavior. You cut off at the ultraviolet. This is the whole Klebanov-Strassler construction is exactly like that, where you actually cut off at the ultraviolet and the infrared, and you try to join it to some finite space. But we find that it's completely insensitive to all this thing. All it depends upon the warp factor right at the bottom of the scope, which we might be able to have a control because this is in our hand where we do the cutoff. So we seem to be having, there at least in this kind of background, there is, we can construct background where there is the axiomatic decay constant may lie in the region of.
But in the global geometry, is controlled by some complex structure module or something like this?
We haven't studied the full moduli structure of this one. But in the global geometry, yes, it would be controlled by that. Okay. So here is one model which is look like that. I got interested because it's an example of a non-Kähler manifold, but it could also bring down the f of a to this kind of region.
Am I allowed to think about, so the way that you're removing the singular points, is there something that becomes massless at the singular points which allows
you to? Okay, so if you write the S5, okay, the metric for an S5 can be written in the following way. For example, if I write the metric for an S5, so the metric for an S5 in coordinate these kind of gamma is given by d gamma square. Cos square gamma d phi 3 square plus sine square gamma d psi square plus cos square psi d51 square plus sine square psi d53 square. So this is the S5, the standard S5 of ADS5. You see near gamma equal to 0, this whole cycle shrinks to 0 size. Yeah. Now, to get this manifold from this to this manifold from this, we make certain set of UT evaluations. along these, because you see there are isometries along phi 1 and phi 2 direction. If you make theta 1, okay, but the point where with gamma goes to 0 or psi goes to pi by 2, these cycles shrink to 0 size. And hence the theta 1 manifold has this kind of simplicity. But you can, so if you can, instead of making the radius shrink to completely to 0 size, to stop it before shrinking to 0 size, then the theta 1 manifold will be finite. This is what I meant by singularity.
So how exactly does this manifold solve the Bianchi identities?
Oh, it does. So that's a very interesting question.
With what vector bundle?
Right. So it turns out that, it's a good question. It turns out that the vector bundle which E8 cross E8 has to be broken to either E7 or SO8. The most simple way by which it solves the Bianchi identity that D of H is not equal to 0. From here you might think that D of H is equal to 0, but there is an order of alpha prime correction. And we found the vector bundle for this case. And it turns out that the vector bundle is not E8 cross E8, it's E7. It's E8 cross E8 is completely broken to E7 by some Wilson line in the electrotic side, or SO8.
Wait. You know the curvature of this vector bundle exactly, or?
We have a dual picture by which we know the curvature of the vector bundle here. In fact, it's very interesting that since these models are dragged from the type 2B side to the heterotic side, all you have to look for the type 2B side is how to insert 7 brain in this background. See, if you insert 7 brain in this background, under T dual it will become 9 brain, under S dual it will become vector bundle. But you know in S5, if you just by hand if you insert 7 brain, it will break the conformal structure of the theory. But there are certain constant coupling configurations studied by Malvasena and Fayazuddin and all, that there are certain set of constant coupling configuration in which you can insert 7 brain. And these 7 brain are exactly which breaks the which gives us the gauge group of either E6, E7, E8, or SO8. Okay? Alternative way is to lift it to F theory and see those constant coupling points. So we lifted it to F theory and saw the constant coupling point. But once we insert 7 brain in this background, we know exactly what 7 brain we have inserted and what is the gauge group on the 7 brain. Now I dualize it. I go to the heterotic side, the 7 brain become 9 brain, then I make an S duality. It becomes vector bundle, and I know exactly what is the vector bundle in this case. So I know the curvature. Without solving the Donaldson-Ulam and Bakke-Yau equation, I should be able to figure that out. So it's an interesting thing that you can actually figure out the vector bundle on the dual side.
But again, it's only locally defined, right?
Huh?
It's only locally defined.
Yes, it turns out so. That this is how the... So I gave this result to my colleague Hassan. And Hassan is not a string theorist, so he never believes in all these duality transformations. What he did is that he plugged every all solution, the, plugged this solution in the GR tensor. And he solved the Einstein equation, and it solved the Einstein equation. So he got convinced that at least, so since he does not believe in T duality and S duality of string theory, so he solved it using equation of motion, and it actually solves exactly the equation of motion. So if you don't want to believe all these duality of string theory, you can just take this solution, plug it into the GR tensor with these well or dilatum and all, you find that it solves the equation of motion. Yes, we dualize it from ADS5 plus S5, which is a supersymmetric.
But at some point, if you duality, you've got some singularities.
Okay, you might. Okay, so the point at which it's become singular, we change the manifold. So, okay, so that we are I'm not 100% sure whether it preserves the supersymmetry or not. But that's not the main concern of our thing. Of our, it solves equation of motion, and it seems to resolve this issue about the axiom decay constant. So in last 2 minutes, I can quickly tell you how we got it, how I got it actually from the 2,2 and 0,2 model, but it's not very relevant for this whole discussion. If you don't want to believe that, you can actually solve this equation. But the simplest way to get 0,2 from 2,2 model is to just kill off the 2,2 supersymmetry. It's the simplest way people get 0,2 from 2,2. But you cannot just simply kill off the geometry in the presence of a torsion, there's some procedure by which you have to kill off the left moving supersymmetry. And there are various procedures known from earlier days of string theory. We use those techniques to get this manifold. It turned out that these techniques boils down to taking two T2RVT and NS2RVT in this manifold. There's nothing too deep going on here. It's a simple case of a duality transformation. Okay. So that's basically what I have to say. Thanks.
So in addition to this axiom, do you have any other axioms in this model? Or you need to know the global structure for
it? I need to know the global structure to get the compactification or the moduli of the manifold. I don't know the moduli of this manifold.
Any other questions? So let's thank the speaker again.